The NBA is suspended. The world is pretty much on lockdown. But here on Locked On NBA, we are still going to be bringing you great NBA content. In today's show, I'm going to Atlanta to speak with Brad Rowland of Locked On Hawks. I'm going to Boston to speak with John Corrales of Locked On Celtics. And I'm going to Brooklyn to speak with Josh Bass of Locked On Nets to talk about why they fell in love with the teams that they follow, their favorite players, their favorite memories, and some obscure under-the-radar players that they really stand for. It's all coming up, the biggest stories with the local experts on Locked On NBA.
You are Locked On the NBA, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
Hello, guys, and welcome back to another week of Locked On NBA. I am your Monday host, Josh Lloyd, also the host of the Locked On Fantasy Basketball Podcast and the lead analyst at Basketball Monster and at Yahoo Sports Australia. Of course, there's no NBA action going on at the moment, so I thought what we'd do is talk to some of the hosts across the network and talk about why they fell in love with their teams, what made them be basketball fans to the degree that they are, what players really inspired them throughout their history of watching their team. So we're talking to the Hawks, we're talking to the Celtics, and we're talking about the Nets on today's show. So let's get to it. Let's bring in now the host of the Locked On Hawks podcast. Brad Rowland is here with me, and during this corona-induced hiatus, what I thought it was a good idea is to talk to hosts across the Locked On podcast network about why they are fans of the teams that they cover. Brad, the Atlanta Hawks, when did you become a fan of them?
Ooh, it's been a long time. I grew up in Atlanta and basically was a Hawks fan for the duration. I definitely got more serious about it, you know, late high school into college, started going to more games, had season tickets a couple times in college, and just kind of grew from there. But yeah, it was kind of ingrained in me from a pretty young age as someone who loved basketball and happened to be in the city.
So is that something that's throughout your whole family? So your parents, brothers, they're all Hawks fans?
Not really, actually. I think as a lot of people in this region, Atlanta's not a huge NBA city, at least not a huge Hawks city. And you kind of have to love it and go out of your way, at least in my experience growing up. So, I mean, not that anybody was super anti-Hawks around me, but I was kind of the only Hawks fan that was like a diehard that I even knew. People like basketball, but the Hawks just aren't on that level, at least haven't been on that level for quite some time in the city. So it was kind of an outlier to be a big time Hawks fan, which was kind of nice in some ways. It kind of fits into my personality to be a fan of a team that not everybody was a fan of. But yeah, I actually didn't kind of grow up in it. It was more of being in the city for sure, but not something that I was actually sort of born into like that.
So that you talk about, you know, the Hawks not being a huge draw necessarily in Atlanta when you were growing up. Has there been any changes in that, say, though, through the 60-win season now? Even now, is there an increase in buzz with Trae Young around, obviously having that high-level superstar type of player? Has there, you noticed any changes in that sort of Hawks affinity in the city?
There have been pockets. You know, I was alive technically when the Dominique Wilkins era was happening in the 80s, but I wasn't, you know, fully all the way here. So that was apparently from all reports, like the time that was, I think the Hawks were the hottest in the city. That was kind of before me. But when I was kind of coming of age as a Hawks fan, you know, in the mid 90s, they had that Dikembe Mutombo team that had some buzz, but wasn't exactly, you know, the number one thing in the city. And then for a long time, they were pretty bad. When I was becoming a real diehard fan, they were awful. I mean, that was for almost a decade, they were pretty terrible. And then they finally got good. And with the Al Horford team, the Joe Johnson team. And I think, you know, the 61 season was kind of the crescendo of when I was a fan. Obviously, people got on board when they went undefeated for that whole month and made that huge run. It kind of became a pretty cool thing, and they were selling out the building, et cetera, et cetera. But honestly, aside from that, you know, month and a half, 2 months, I think there was more of a boom locally with that team, but it was never the same kind of passion that you would see for the local baseball team or football team, something like that. And I think after that, there was a pretty big downturn. Now with Trae Young, I think in taking the temperature of the city, I think people are more excited and getting more on board. They've been kind of looking for a superstar for a long time, and Trae Young being that will certainly, I think, breed some more fans. But for the most part, it's never really, really caught fire aside from that like 2 month span in 2015.
How did you go, you know, growing up through school and into college days, when we know that, yeah, Atlanta, there's always been that big, hey, there's so many Lakers fans in the crowd, all these Kobe jerseys outnumbering the Hawks jerseys. Yeah, how much was that an issue for you, you know, growing up in the city and having, you know, which I assume, yeah, multiple of your friends and colleagues supporting teams like the Lakers?
Yeah, it certainly used to bother me a lot more. I think if you are a diehard fan of a team, and most of the coverage that happened around the Hawks and Hawks fans was other media members poking fun at the building being empty, or there being so many Hawks fans, so many non-Hawks fans, and, you know, MVP chants for Kobe and LeBron, that kind of stuff. So it definitely bothered me, and I think it still bothers people now, just because there's that national perception, I think more than anything, of Atlanta as a city that kind of gets piled on for. And some of it honestly is accurate. I mean, taking a step back from it a little bit now, as I do more covering the team and actually being a fan of the team, it's probably accurate to some degree to say that, listen, this fan base is not that big and it's not that passionate in some circles, but there are diehards and there are people that love this team. So if you're in that group, it certainly is bothersome when most of the national perception is just kind of people making fun of Atlanta and the Hawks. So certainly was not ideal during those times, but and that's kind of what makes the better times better, just when the team is actually good and they kind of draw that stuff out. Because, and by the way, I mean, again, taking a step back from it a second ago, it's kind of fun, I would say, now, because you get that when good teams are in the building, you have their fans in the building, and it kind of gets that back and forth atmosphere, almost like a neutral site. As funny as that is, you kind of have the really passionate Hawks fans that paid, you know, more than normal to be there to play against the Lakers, and then you have Lakers fans. So it kind of becomes this really raucous atmosphere, which can be fun as well, even if it's not exactly perfect in terms of home court advantage.
Yeah, well, that's something that happens over here, not necessarily with our basketball, with our biggest sport, Australian football, is because there's 10 of the, I think it's 10 or 9 of the 18 teams are all based in Melbourne. So many of the games are teams whose home bases are located 2-3 kilometers apart from each other. So you get that neutral site every game, and it does really amplify that that feeling and a lot more tension in the air when those sort of things do happen. So I can totally understand that point of view. Now, who is your favorite Hawks player of all time?
Ooh, I mean, I think just kind of growing up as I was, I didn't see Dominique a whole lot when I was, you know, I was very, very young, but he's kind of the guy that everyone has held in that highest esteem for the Hawks, as the best player in Atlanta franchise history. You know, Bob Pettit played for the Hawks too, but that was in St. Louis mostly. So in Atlanta, Dominique's like the guy. You know, my favorite player, pre me covering the team and into when I first started covering the team, is probably Al Horford. I was a big Al Horford guy. Of course, that kind of soured for some people when he left and free agency, which I totally understand. But, you know, sort of combining the aspect of being a fan and then also getting to know him a little bit, you know, not like friendly, but necessarily, you know, I was covering him, talking to him, interviewing him. I was always a big Al Horford guy. So he'd probably be my answer. I probably liked players, you know, equally as much probably, but just in terms of that crossover appeal and it kind of, as you probably know, or can guess, you know, covering a team versus being a fan of a team is a little bit different. Yeah. And he kind of crossed over from one to the other for me. So he probably would be the guy that I would name, but Dominique is still like the number one for pretty much anyone my age, I would imagine.
What about, yeah, sort of an under the radar player? So yeah, there's a lot of people who are going to say Dominique, or going to say, yeah, nowadays Trae Young or Al Horford, yeah, or whoever it is. But like a guy that maybe you might find, you know, 5 other people who go, you know what, this guy, he was really my guy, and I'm really on the whoever it is bandwagon. Like, who was that player for you?
I have a couple. I really loved Elton Brand, and this is like old Elton Brand, not good 2010 Elton Brand from the Clippers, like Hawks Elton Brand. He was like a backup big for the Hawks. I loved him when he was here. Going back to my younger days, I really liked this guard named Eldridge Rakazner, and I always used to make jokes about him, even now on Twitter when people talk about Hawks stuff. I was like 10, and he was my guy when I was 10 years old on those mid-90s Hawks teams. Guys like, you know, Dermar Johnson. I had a Dermar Johnson jersey. He was a top 10 pick for the Hawks. It did not pan out whatsoever, but I really wanted him to be good. That kind of stuff, you always have your guys. I think my most recent one of those guys would be, I was a big Damari Carroll guy, and even as someone covering the team, I was a big Justin Anderson guy. I love Justin Anderson. He's still in the league, of course, now. I lean into my bit a little bit with that. I talk about how much I love him, but he's probably my favorite example of that recently. Even someone who's not a fan of the team, I always just love Justin Anderson.
That is exactly where I was trying to go with that question, is to get someone like a Justin Anderson out of it. Because, you know, I actually like Justin Anderson quite a bit as well, and I don't understand why he can't really stick. Is he on a team?
I don't either.
Because he went to Brooklyn for a bit. I don't know if they cut him or not. I have to check
that
out.
No, he was back in the G League after that. He had a 50-point game in the G League this year, which I find hilarious. Because he's not really a scorer.
No, he's not.
I didn't see that game, but I was like, man, I'm not sure how that even works for Justin Anderson. But yeah, I will always love him going back to Virginia and everything.
All right, Brad, that is fantastic. Thank you for jumping on and providing a little bit of background into why you love the Atlanta Hawks. Thanks for jumping on, and people can check out what you're doing over on Locked On Hawks to help them get through this minimum 30-day hiatus that we're on.
Yeah, hop on over to Locked On Hawks. Also follow me on Twitter at BTRoll, and we'll be here trying to create some content just like you are.
Hey, we're all stuck at home now due to COVID-19, so what better way to get stuff delivered to you than by using Postmates? I remember when I was in the States last year, it was in Vegas after Summer League, I think it was about 2 a.m. back in the hotel. My girlfriend was like, oh, I really feel like some food. I go, it's 2 a.m. I know it's Vegas, but can you really be bothered going out? She goes, no, what? You know, I'm going to download Postmates. And we did that and ordered some fried chicken from somewhere down the strip, and it got delivered to us. Fantastic. Didn't have to put in our clothes to go back outside to do anything at that sort of time of night. But Postmates, they came through in the clutch and brought us that fried chicken at a very, very late time in the night. So, if you're like me, you're probably thinking about what you want to eat for dinner, and if you can't go out to the grocery store, Postmates is going to be able to bring you that food. They deliver food from every restaurant that I can think of right to my door. They don't just deliver burgers and sushi and fried chicken. They make my life easy with grocery deliveries and whatever I can think of deliveries to. Convenience stores, clothing stores, you name it. No more trips to the store. Hey, and many of us can't even do that. No more late night fast food runs. You don't even have to worry about where to grab lunch anymore. Just download Postmates on iOS or Android. Find your favorites and get anything you want delivered within the hour. For a limited time, Postmates is giving our listeners $100 of free delivery credit for your first 7 days. To start your free deliveries, download the app and use the code LOCKEDONNBA. That's code LOCKEDONNBA for $100 of free delivery credit with no minimum purchase for your first 7 days when you download the Postmates app. Anything you need, anytime you need it, Postmate it. Now let's go to Boston to speak with the Locked On Celtics host, John Corrales. John, when did you become a Celtics fan?
You know, it's kind of different for me than I think for most people, because I started following basketball when I was maybe like going into my teenage years. My parents are Greek immigrants, so I'm first generation. And so I didn't have like a history of a dad taking me to the Garden and watching John Havlicek play. I just happened to be tall, and I started to get into basketball. And as I got into basketball and playing it, I started to watch it. And so my first real exposure to the Boston Celtics, because I'm from Rhode Island, only about 35, 40 miles away, was the early 80s and, you know, the Larry Bird, Kevin McHale, Robert Parrish Boston Celtics. So that was my first exposure.
So you're going to be, you know, quite different to a lot of the hosts that I talk about on these shows, given the history of success that you have lived through from an early age. But you know, you have that, and that happens to, you know, in a lot of sports, who kids grow up and they follow the team who's successful. You know, not saying that you're jumping on the bandwagon given from where you grew up, but that happens to a lot of kids, and then they go through that, you know, that darker period. So what was it like transitioning from you know, starting to watch it, watching Bird, watching McHale, and then going through some of those lean times later on?
Yeah. Well, so when I remember distinctly when I was first really watching basketball, I started to think, how does any team win? Because they all keep making baskets. Like I didn't really notice people missing shots. You had that early bit of success, and at that point, like, Boston has this reputation now. There are a lot of kids in their 20s who've never known anything but success. But back then, the Celtics were kind of the only success in town. The Red Sox hadn't won in forever. The Bruins hadn't won in forever. The Patriots were just terrible. They were a joke.
Oh, yes.
And so
the Scott Zolak year.
Yeah, yeah. So that was those were lean times in Boston. You just lean on the Celtics to be your championship team. And then, you know, as I got to know the team, I studied the history a little bit more, and you realize that going into the 90s there, things were going to be a lot different. I mean, you had the death of Reggie Lewis, you had the death of Len Bias, you had some really obviously just brutally horrible luck in that regard. And then you get into Rick Pitino years, and I was a Rick Pitino fan when I was a kid. You know, he was coach of Providence College and made their improbable Final Four run. And so I was excited. And, you know, as that kind of progressed, you know, you start to get a little more antsy because that's not how it's supposed to go for these guys. So the angst there was pretty high, and it was exacerbated by the fact that there was no other Boston team that was kind of making up the difference.
How was it to be a Celtics fan during the Len Bias and Reggie Lewis situations? Because it's rare to have active players die really in any sport at any point, but to have two of them within what a 10-year period, it's pretty hard. So how did you come across? How did you find out the news of both of those situations, and how did you process it, you know, as a younger kid and then a little bit older when Reggie Lewis passed away?
Yeah, when I was younger, it was kind of hard. I wasn't really. It didn't hit me the same way as Reggie Lewis did, when I heard about Len Bias, because I didn't really know much. You know, college basketball wasn't huge on TV, especially Maryland basketball. Like I didn't see a lot. I'd heard, and then that happened, and you were like, wow, this is horrible. But he was never a Celtic, so it never, for me at that particular age, it never hit me in a huge way. Reggie Lewis was devastating. I mean, I was at that prime, like old enough where I was like really infatuated. Like that's when you really get like live and die with the team kind of fandom. And when Reggie went down, man, you talk about you cry for days, you know, it's hard to describe because he was this up and coming all-star, like superstar type player.
He was really good.
He was so good. And he was going to carry this team. Like he was the guy. We're pinning our hopes on this guy. And he was always doing nice things around Boston. Like you could see him out being charitable. He had this great demeanor about himself, you know, handing out turkeys at Thanksgiving. And so you had this sense of like, you didn't just lose the future of your franchise. You lost this guy who was amazing in the city. And like he went to Northeastern. So he really embraced Boston. And I mean, that was devastating. That was a hard one to take. And, you know, you think back on hearing about it. I forget where I was, but I just remember walking around in a daze, and then the funeral just brought it all back. It was kind of like at that point losing a member of the extended family.
Yeah, I remember Reggie Lewis from when I was growing up and hearing that terrible news, but I'm just looking at his basketball reference page at the moment. Like his last two seasons, he scored 21 points a game. He scored over 18 points for every year of his career, apart from his rookie year where he barely played. So he was put into a big role basically, you know, second year onwards. He was playing 33 minutes a night, yeah, shooting the ball well, yeah, just a really talented player. And it harkens back to him when he died was probably about, yeah, you know, I'd say 2 or 3 years after I really started following the NBA. So, you know, taking it back to that was a terrible thing, because he was, again, that up-and-coming star who was, you know, 27 when he passed away and pushing into those All-Star games, which he did make an All-Star game at that point. Now, don't want to dwell too much on the sadness side of things, John, but let's talk a little bit more positive. Who is your all-time favorite Celtic player?
Well, I mean, it has to be Larry Bird. Right. Like it has to be that's the guy that was leading those teams as I was becoming a big time basketball fan. So it's hard for me to say anybody other than Larry Bird, although Paul Pierce really is a close second just because of his story. And I saw it the entirety of his career. It wasn't the same as like Larry Bird when I was young and I was just kind of discovering, and I didn't know who Larry Bird was when he got drafted. And, you know, obviously the rest of the country did, but for Pierce, the story of him being this brash young kid who came in like in an era of NBA basketball where everybody kind of had a little extra attitude, it seemed like, and the reclamation, the, the redemption, the, you know, him coming to a point where he could have asked out and the Celtics could have traded him. They allegedly were very close to a trade on draft night for Chris Paul, and it never worked out. But to have that kind of turnaround for Pierce and have him say, you know what, I am going to commit to this. I am going to change my attitude. And then to see him kind of be one of the leaders on a team that comes back, and then all of a sudden they win that championship. He's very close to Larry Bird, in my opinion, because on a personal level, you kind of root for him. You know, he almost died. He came back and he played, and to have that full circle, like, his story is an amazing one, and I'm glad that he can be considered one of Boston's legends.
One last question before I let you go, John. Like an underrated player that you and maybe a handful of other people go, you know, I really believe in this guy. So over the course of time, there's all these players that you say, you know, I really believe in this guy. He's my guy. Who's that player for you in Celtics history? Not the big names necessarily, just that player who, hey, many people may not even remember. Who was that guy for you?
Oh, geez. Well, I'm not going to go with a guy that many people don't remember, because I'm going to say Dennis Johnson, because Dennis Johnson's importance to that big three, like people always think about the big three era, and obviously everybody remembers Dennis Johnson, but Dennis Johnson was crucial to those teams. And as great as they were, and they probably would have still won championships, but he made that work. He was the glue guy with them. And I'll just go to the Larry Bird steal against the Detroit Pistons, where everybody knows the call, like Larry Bird steals it. And the second half of that call from Johnny Most is underneath to DJ, and he lays it in. That, I think, is the perfect example of what Dennis Johnson meant to this team, because it's Larry Bird making this exceptional play, and everybody knows it as Larry Bird steal, but it's also DJ understanding what just happened, breaking the instant he saw it happen, and being there for Larry Bird to just kind of finish things off. And obviously Larry Bird is the spectacular end of that, and DJ is the business end of that. And I think that's just a perfect encapsulation of Dennis Johnson's time in Boston. I think that for all of the love that so many greats in Boston get, I think that he's a guy that doesn't get enough. And then, you know, one more, I'll just throw one more real quick out there. Sam Jones is criminally underrated, and I didn't see him play, but I just want to throw it out there that Sam Jones is one of the greatest players in Celtics history. And because of when he played and who he played with, he's one of the greatest scorers in NBA history. He's a legend, and not enough people talk about Sam Jones.
The Dennis Johnson, Sam Jones, he averaged 26 points a game one season. I'm just looking it up now. That's pretty crazy. The Dennis Johnson ones, you say, like, you know, everyone remembers him. I don't think that's necessarily the case, because there were people who may not have watched, you know, 80 Celtics, but they still know McHale, they still know Parrish, they still know Bird. Like, they know those three, but they don't necessarily know those other guys around them. And I think that is, it's an important thing to note. If you weren't necessarily there, you may not remember the impact someone like Dennis Johnson had. John, thank you for coming on and talking about your Celtics fandom with me here on Locked On NBA, and I'm sure you're going to be having some great stuff going on over on Locked On Celtics to have all of the Celtics fans entertained throughout our self-isolation, social distancing, NBA hiatus, whatever you want to call it. John, thank you again.
You got it, my man.
Now we go to the host of the Locked On Nets podcast. Josh Bass is here with me. Josh, what made you a Nets fan?
Oh my God, Josh, I don't know how much time you have. This is a real trip down memory lane for me. So my dad, just to give you some background, my dad had historically been a Knicks fan. He just kind of got sick of everything. And then once Jason Kidd got traded to the Nets, he became actually a big Nets fan. That was when I first started following basketball at the age of 6 or 7. And it was a good time to be a Nets fan. They were absolutely captivating. One of the funnest teams in the league to watch. Kind of marshaled by Jason Kidd. You had guys flying down the court in Kenyon Martin, Kerry Kittles, Richard Jefferson. And to take everyone back to 2002, 2003 timeframe, you know, there weren't a lot of teams playing that fast like the Nets. Everyone was kind of bogging it down, playing slowly, throwing it into the post. And the Nets were really the main team that prided themselves on really running and gunning, getting into it defensively. Offensively, they actually weren't very good, but were able to really get out and transition. And just seeing all those athletes on the court made me fall in love with basketball and specifically the Nets.
So you were obviously a fan back from the New Jersey days and then and moved with them over to mm-hmm. Brooklyn. What was your favorite team during that time?
Yeah, I think, you know, it probably had to be that first team, I'd say. The 2001, 2002 team, or even like that kind of vintage of teams, I'd say was the best. Just because you had got like even the role players that they had. I mean, Lucius Harris was like a little used backup guard. He probably played 15 minutes a game or so, but he would just get into it defensively and grind. You had obviously Scalabrine. Not many people know this, but, you know, before he became an icon with the Celtics, he was a player for the Nets, and he was a guy that got used in their rotation. There was one game in the Eastern Conference Finals, the year that Detroit won the championship. So I guess that was 04, where it was a triple overtime game. I remember listening to it on a transistor radio because we were out and we'd driven out to from Manhattan out to Long Island, and we didn't have a TV and couldn't watch the game at that time. Listening on that radio as Scal dropped like 30 points, I think it was one of the most insane games ever. Chauncey Billups had brought it to overtime by hitting like a half court shot in regulation to tie it up. Triple overtime game, the Nets won. It was one of the happiest moments of my formative years. So any of those teams from that era, just because there were so many great role guys. Aaron Williams was another guy who was part of the Vince Carter trade and got sent to Toronto. But he was like this jacked dude who would like be great in the modern NBA, blocking shots, dunking. He was just everywhere for the Nets as like a little known backup big guy, but someone who's really fun to watch.
Who is your favorite Nets player of all time?
I think it has to be our man, Brook Lopez. You know, just obviously as a player, really great to watch. I think for Nets fans, it's really interesting to see his evolution from when he first got drafted with the Nets at the 10th pick. You know, he wasn't someone that was expected to fall for them. He was supposed to go in the top five. He does drop to number 10, has a really great rookie season, and then following it up second year, and then was kind of on those terrible teams. He was on the 12-70 team and just really couldn't catch a break, makes an all-star team, then deals with all of the injuries. Lionel Hollins comes in as coach and hates him, and then he's released with Kenny Atkinson and allowed to shoot three-pointers. And like his evolution being on the team for all those years and not seeing a ton of winning, but still being one, a great locker room presence and a great guy. And then also all of his off the court antics. He's like one of the funnest players ever, I think, and such an interesting character from the NBA. He definitely has a very special place in my soul. So he has to be the number one choice there.
He averaged almost 19 points a game during his nine seasons with New Jersey and Brooklyn, blocked 1.7 shots, but the 3-point shooting is absolutely wild from him. He hit 137 threes in his Nets career. And all but three of those came in that last season. So he had hit 0-0-0, 0-0-0, 1 and 2, and then 134. Mm-hmm. It is one of the wildest changes in not only percentage, because he only hit like 2 of 14 the year before, but just volume and the fact that he just started going crazy from down there. It was one of those wild things. I remember that happened with Al Horford as well at around a similar time, and even Marc Gasol that never took threes and all of a sudden were banging in 100-plus per season. And Lopez, one of those guys leading the charge there with Brooklyn, and then off to the Lakers, then off to, of course, to the Bucks as we currently sit now. Brook Lopez is a name that many Nets. Go ahead.
Yeah, just one other thing on Brook. Like, think about it, Josh. How like he was so maligned, even though he was a good statistic player on those last few seasons with the Nets before, I think, the 3-point shooting, as someone who was soft. People would criticize his lack of rebound because he was like pulling down 5 or 6 a game. Lionel Hollins hated him and benched him for Mason Plumlee at that time, which was ridiculous. And now to see his perception around the league change, where he's such a valued part of what was the best team in the league in the Milwaukee Bucks, and someone that was warranted or not warranted getting Defensive Player of the Year consideration. It's crazy to see how much people have begun to respect his game. It really all started with that 3-point shot.
Yeah, that 14-15 season, he only started 44 of the 72 games that he plays, which is wild. And the narrative about him changed so much because he played every single game for the first 3 years of his career, then broke his foot and played five. Mm-hmm. Came back, played 74 games, broke his foot again and played 17. Everyone's like, oh, can't ever stay healthy. He's finished. And it was like, okay, he missed 2 years. But then basically he's been healthy ever since and doesn't really get hurt at all and didn't get hurt at all to begin his career. Now, everyone, you know, especially modern fans, know about Brook Lopez. But what's an under-the-radar player? Someone that you and maybe a handful of other people are like, you know, this is my guy. This is the player that I'm really here for. Even if coaches or general managers or the league itself or other people didn't fully agree, who was that guy for you?
Yeah, it has to be the guy that Nets fans call Starshawn, Marshawn Brooks. He came in really high scoring guard out of Providence. I'm serious, Josh. Had one season with the Nets, was able to just drop so many buckets. I mean, he was a really talented scorer. I think a lot of people remember him for being in his two seasons with the Nets, the guy that threw the alley-oop pass to Gerald Green on that insane, remember that 360 dunk that he had, or windmill dunk that he had on the alley-oop. But he was a really good player in his own right that first season, a guy with a lot of potential. Unfortunately, in that season, once the Nets moved to Brooklyn that second year, he really fell out of favor with the group there. They traded him as part of that Pierce and KG trade, and he was a tough pill to swallow in letting him go, and he was someone that Boston really wanted. Unfortunately, he did flame out of the league, went to China, and I think Nets fans were probably the ones that were most excited when he was able to make that brief comeback with Memphis, and obviously getting in the news a bit when the Suns thought they were trading for for Dylan, or was it the Suns or Wizards that thought they were trading for Dylan Brooks as opposed to him?
I think it was the Suns.
Underrated guy.
Yeah, he came in and was fantastic in that first season and then didn't get to double figures or double digit scoring average at all after that first season. But I'm going to pull it up now because I remember looking at his numbers in China, and they were, I know everyone's numbers in China are pretty crazy. But his scoring, where is it? There it is. Yeah, he had the 17-18 season, he averaged 37 points a game for Jiangsu Kendia what did he shoot? 41% from three, 51% from the field.
Guy can get buckets, I'm telling you.
Yeah, it was crazy. And that was one of those names that he just sort of just came out of nowhere in that season to be this big scoring guard in the 50 games or so that he played as a rookie. Josh, you're going to be giving all Nets fans content over on Locked On Nets throughout this season suspension. So guys, check it out over there. And thanks for coming on Locked On NBA with me.
Always a pleasure to talk Marshawn Brooks. Thanks, Josh.
And that'll do it for today's episode of Locked On NBA. Make sure you're subscribed so you never miss an episode. We're going to be putting out great stuff for you to get you through without any sports on at the moment. So subscribe to Locked On NBA, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. And if you give us a 5-star review, that would be absolutely fantastic. Go check out your favorite team right across the Locked On Podcast Network as well. Follow me on Twitter at @RedRock_Beeble and the network at Locked On NBA Net. Guys, we are done here. Thank you so much for listening, everyone. See ya.